Thank you very much. So, having remembered the title of my talk again, the title is What the Buddha Was Actually Like and How That Is Relevant to Us. So, I wanted to give this talk not only celebrating the Buddha's victory of enlightenment, but more importantly, how it is relevant to our lives. Yeah, we, as you've seen in the study and with the mantras and with the meditation, we've been revering the Buddha. But remember that we are also making that commitment to enlightenment. So Buddha means awakened one. And he awakened to reality. He saw how things actually were. So I'm going to apologize now if I go off, take tangents. But there's some things before I got this talk properly together that I wanted to say, and it may not quite be related to the title, but I still feel it's important to say. So the Buddha, the Buddha became awake. I've got a particular concern that when we talk about reality, we talk about it as a thing. You know, even as Buddhists, we say that we, these fixed things that we are waking up to reality, a fixed thing that is. But neither we or reality are fixed. We're both processes. Yeah? So when we talk about waking up, it's a process. So we may not be awake like the Buddha was. The Buddha woke up to how things were, woke up to reality. But maybe we can empathize with the Buddha. And by our waking up, what we're doing when we're waking up to our feelings, to our energies, to our likes and dislikes, and eventually to reality. So in some ways, waking up can be, see it as a metaphor. It's a rather imperfect way of describing the path. You'll note that I didn't call this talk, What is Enlightenment? Yeah, it'd be a very short talk, it would be a very bumbling talk. So what I'm going to do is describe what the Buddha was really like by his actions. As you can see, I'm not 2,500 years old, so I'm not going to tell you what the Buddha was actually like from personal experience, but reading about him, his life and his actions, hopefully we'll get a flavour of what the Buddha was actually like. So I've just said that the Buddha got enlightened, and we heard in the readings that the enlightenment meant the Buddha overcame Mara. Mara being the evil one, the tempter, or even death. Note, if you weren't here for study, the one thing that we tried to bring out in study wasn't so much the overcoming of death or evil, but describing the Buddha in terms of the three knowledges. So when the Buddha gained enlightenment, he gained these three knowledges. The first one was knowledge of his past lives. And this is quite contentious, isn't it? We did some study this morning where not everyone believes in the concept of past lives. So I'd say this. Do you believe that actions have consequences? If you see and believe that, that's enough. Yeah? So what the Buddha saw really is actions have consequences. So please don't get too upset or hung up on the idea of, do I believe in past lives? Yes, it's important, but more important this life is that we become aware that actions have consequences. Again, another contentious topic, he became aware of karma. Luckily for you, I'm not going to spend the whole talk describing karma. So karma being, again, actions having consequences, seeing people doing skillful actions, good things, and what that happened there, and when people did not so good things, not so unskillful things, what were the consequences of those? Finally, the Buddha became aware of something called the destruction of the Ashravas. So really, the Buddha became aware that greed, hatred, and delusion had been annihilated. So what was the Buddha actually like? How I'm going to do this, I first started out thinking that I'm going to describe a few stories. I will, but what I noticed when I was preparing this talk is that there's contradictions. Yeah, I found that in one instance, the Buddha behaved in such a way, and in the next instance I read about, he seemed to behave in the opposite way. So it's not to say that the Buddha contradicted himself. I would, at least the text that I looked at, there were reasons why the Buddha appears to give the opposite advice. And that's fine. You know, the Buddha was complex. We're complex. You might find with your own life how one day you're following a particular teaching, and on the next day or the next week, that what you're following seems to contradict that. Okay? It may well be that you read the texts and it seems as though the Buddha contradicts himself. I think it's important we sit with that. You know, you might think maybe the Buddha was wrong, but I'd ask you to look a bit deeper. Why would it be that the Buddha contradicted himself? Why do you think? So we know about the Buddha before he became the Buddha, Gotama. He left home, he went forth, he took up some so-called ascetic practices. The less said, the better. One account I read said that one of the practices, obviously starving himself, going without food, even eating excrement, cow excrement. Blimey. You know, I'm not sure that I know many people today who go to those kind of practices, but there we go. He nearly died starving himself to death. And then what happened? As the Buddha to be was on the point of death, what happened? Well, he had a recollection of his previous life when he was a prince, sitting in his father's kingdom, looking across at the landscape. I'll just read a bit about it. I thought of a time when my Shakyamuni father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome things. I'd entered upon and abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring. I thought, might this be the way to enlightenment? Then, following up from that, a memory arose that came with a recognition that this was the way to enlightenment. Then I thought, why am I afraid of such pleasure? It is a pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual desires and unwholesome things. Then I thought, I am not afraid of such pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sensual desires and unwholesome things. So the key thing here is, the Buddha to be wasn't struggling to get into this wonderful state. It's when he stopped struggling and he relaxed and remembered what it was like when he could sit there apart, secluded. So really, if our path doesn't have pleasure in it, if your spiritual life doesn't have pleasure in it, I'm not talking about unwanted pleasures, but if it's not got pleasure in it of this kind, ask yourself why. It can be hard work, can't it, the spiritual life? I've just said that we don't take up ascetic practices, but do we in our own lives have this pleasure that we're not ashamed of? Can we seclude ourselves from desires, from unwholesome things? And I was saying in our study group this morning, I think most of us have, maybe it was last week, normally in our childhood, I would wager a bet that all of us had an experience where we were just, in our normal lives, set apart when we were young, and something beautiful arose, like the Buddha experienced. Maybe we didn't go on to become enlightened, but we've all had that experience. It's simply remembering it and using it. But then we hear about pleasure on the path, and then I came across this. So this is the Buddha speaking to his monks. This is taken from the Apativana Sutta, the Sutras on Relentlessness. Monks, I have known two qualities through experience: discontent, regard to skillful qualities, and unrelenting exertion. Relentlessly, I exerted myself, thinking, gladly I would let flesh and blood in my body dry up, leaving just the skin, tendons, and bones. But if I have not attained what can be reached through human firmness, human persistence, human striving, there will be no relaxing my persistence. From this heedfulness of mine was attained awakening. From this heedfulness of mine was attained unexcelled freedom from bondage. So on one hand, we have the Buddha talking about, I remember a time when I was young, and then meditation naturally occurred. And in the next instance, we've got the Buddha saying, gladly would I let flesh and blood in my body dry up. What a contrast. My interpretation of this is, we need inspiration for the path. The Buddha needed inspiration for the path. And as you'll find, once we have that inspiration, we give ourselves wholeheartedly. We don't just accept second class or mediocre. We really have an urgency for the path. Yeah. So if you really, you know, you're lucky enough, we're lucky enough to have discovered the teaching of the Buddha. We're lucky enough to be in a time when we can practice it. Of course, I'm not suggesting that you don't drink, take any, eat anything or drink anything until you die. But maybe that sense of urgency is missing from our lives. Yeah, could we practice well? We don't know how long we've got, and it's a lot less longer than we think. So in this sense, the Buddha's saying, be inspired, don't accept second best, and really, really put your heart into practicing. And you'll find, as I go on in this talk, that the Buddha seems to be open. He seems to say, do what you think. But then when you become his disciple, he's very insistent that you make good, strong effort. I'm not talking about clenching your hands and fists until they're white when you meditate, but making really good effort. Okay, so in the next things we hear about the Buddha, well, he was grateful to the Dharma. So the Buddha becomes enlightened. He sits there for a number of days after enlightenment, and he wonders, who can he reverence? Who can he worship now he's gained enlightenment? He looks about and he sees no teacher, no being who he can reverence. And so after some time meditating, he becomes aware that he would reverence the Dharma, the teaching that's brought him to enlightenment. That's who will reverence. I think I've got a little reading on that. Now, while the Blessed One was alone in retreat, this thought arose in him. He lives unhappily who has nothing to venerate and obey. But what monk or Brahmin is there under who I could live, honour and respect? Then he thought, I could live under another monk or Brahmin, respecting him in order to perfect the unperfected code of virtue and concentration. But I do not see this in this world with its deities, its Maras and its divinities, with its monks and its Brahmins, its princes and its men. But there is this Dharma discovered by me. Suppose I live under this, honouring and respecting that. So this is the Buddha, who's gained enlightenment, who's looking for something or someone to reverence. Now, this has a lot to do with us. I'm going to say something contentious here. I would say that whether we see ourselves to be spiritual or not, religious or not, whether we think we do or not, we all want to reverence something. It may not be the Buddha. It may be somebody else who's living. It might even be a particular ritual. So pay attention to who or what you reverence. If you reverence something really skillful, you move towards becoming kinder, happier on the path of enlightenment. if you reverence something that's unskillful, that has an effect as well. Yeah, I'm not saying we suddenly can reverence everything beautiful and lovely and skillful, but look to see what you're reverencing. Do you agree with that statement? Do you think you reverence, if you don't believe in the Buddha, do you reverence something or somebody? I would propose that you do. So get into contact with that. So here's the Buddha being grateful for his enlightenment. And then what do we hear? We hear the Buddha then ventures out after having this wonderful experience of enlightenment, and he meets somebody. He meets this wanderer, Upaka. And this is how the conversation goes. Upaka says to the Buddha, "Friend, your faculties are serene. Friend, the color of your skin is clear and bright. Under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Or whose Dharma do you confess?" And the Buddha responds like this. So he meets him on the road. They're impressed by him. In India, instead of saying, "How are you doing?" or talking about the weather, as we do here, they get down to nitty-gritty. "Who's your teacher? Your face looks bright. What is his teaching? What does he propose?" And the Buddha responds like this: "I am an all-transcender and all-knower, unsullied by all things, renouncing all, by craving ceasing freed, and this I owe to my own wisdom. To whom should I concede it? I have no teacher, and my like exists nowhere in all the world, with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. I am the teacher in the world, without a peer, accomplished too. I am quite alone, enlightened, quenched, whose fires are all extinct. I go to Kasi city now to set the wheel of the Dharma in motion in a blindfold world. I go to beat the deathless drum. By your claims, friend, you are a universal victor." And Upaka says, "That's very good, that's very good, may it be so." Shakes his head and walks off. So my point on this is, the Buddha sounds very proud here, doesn't he? But what I would say is, when we do things that talk about the Dharma, when we do things that don't reflect on us, it may seem like pride, but it's not. The Buddha really was not so much boasting about his experience, but I would say, and finding it hard to put into words, difficult to, he was celebrating his enlightenment. He was celebrating the Dharma that he revered. There's a difference. If I say to you, "Look at me, how wonderful I am, look at my face, how radiant it is," I'm celebrating myself. But actually, if I talk about the Dharma, if I boast about the Dharma even, for the sake of all beings, it's got a different flavour. So my one point to make here is that, I don't know if you had my experience, sometimes you emerge from meditation or retreat and your face is glowing, and you come back home to meet your family. You might even meet some person on the street, a friend on the street, and they say, "Wow, where have you been?" And if anything like me, you totally alienate them by talking about the retreat in detail or your meditation in detail. So although people might see that we glow, they may not always be receptive, just because we know the Dharma, just because we glow with the Dharma, with the truth, it doesn't mean that everyone or anyone will be receptive to it. So out of all of the things I've read to you so far, I can believe that happened. I can believe the Buddha did seem bright. And I can also believe that somebody met him, wanted to hear a bit about him, what he was saying, but wasn't receptive or didn't believe what he was saying and walked on. Yeah, it seems very believable this happened. Of course, I'll never know. But yeah, the word of caution, you know, just because you know all about the Dharma, just because you might be glowing, be receptive to the people that you meet. Try and engage with them. Don't think that they're going to want to know all about you and your experiences. Like Upaka, they might shake their head and just walk on and think that what you're doing is a bit of nonsense. And that's fine. So the other contradiction, the Buddha gained enlightenment by himself, so to speak. He gained it sitting under the Bodhi tree. For those of you who weren't there for the study this morning, after taking his ascetic practices up, after that memory of his childhood, that fast he was on, where he was starving himself to death, the Buddha stopped that and decided to take food. So his friends abandoned him and left him to it. They thought he was a traitor. They thought he wasn't really into the spiritual life proper and abandoned him. And actually, I don't agree with this. From what I've read, it doesn't quite seem like. But the Buddha gained enlightenment, so to speak, by himself. So he sat in the Bodhi tree by himself. I'd like to make the point here that sometimes on our spiritual journeys, we will need to do things by ourselves. Even our spiritual friends may not agree with what we're doing. So there might be some time, it doesn't mean that, you know, hopefully your friends don't abandon you and stop speaking to you, but maybe what you're doing isn't easy to communicate. What you're doing, maybe you do have to go through by yourself. But the good thing about the Buddha is that after he gained enlightenment, he didn't think, right, you know, those five friends who've abandoned me, I'm not, never going to speak to them. It's actually, he approached them again and said, great, I've got this great teaching. I've experienced enlightenment. Who can I teach? It would be great if they could come, you know, they could share in this. So the other point is, when we do make some good progress in our spiritual life, don't keep it to yourself. Yeah, maybe a local viewer has prompted me to say this. I think there's been times in my life, you know, I thought I had this wonderful teaching, and I thought the teaching would be really wonderful if I just keep it to myself. I won't tell a local viewer how he might be happier. I'll just keep it to myself, and because it's a wonderful, wonderful teaching, and I really don't want anyone else to be happy, I'll keep it to myself. Yeah, I've certainly had that. I can't say that I won't have it again, unfortunately, being honest, but less of it. Yeah. So when you discover something really wonderful in the spiritual life, a wonderful reading, something about the Metta Bhavana, some kind of insight, share it with your friends. Yeah, share it with your friends. This is what the Buddha did. This is what true Dharma is, that we share our realizations, our worries, our breakthroughs. Share them with your friends. Even be brave enough to do that. Even if your friends don't believe you, be brave, share it. So the Buddha did go on to teach, and he taught many people. I want to talk about one particular teaching called the Kalama Sutta. I'm sure that you haven't, maybe you've heard of the Kalama Sutta, but it's very popular in Buddhism. The essence of the sutta is that the Buddha meets these people who've met lots of spiritual teachers, and they say to the Buddha, we've seen lots of people who profess to be spiritual, who profess to know things about the spiritual life. How do we know that what you're saying is true? And the crux of it is that the Buddha says, well, don't go by reports, don't go by legends or traditions or by scriptures or by analogies or because you've been convinced by a teacher. Look at what this teacher is teaching you. Look at what this teacher is saying. Does the actions of what he's suggesting, are they blameless? Are they praised by the wise? If you adopt them, do you become happier? Do they lead to other people's happiness? Remain in them. He also said, make sure that you check that the wise are happy with it. It's not a carte blanche. He's not saying, do what you think. Does it make you feel happy? Great. He's saying, do your wise friends also agree with that? Do the people you consider wise also agree with that? So that's the Kalama Sutta. But then when we read about the Buddha later on, as his career progresses, he develops the Vinaya. So the Vinaya is literally, depending on what country you're in and whether you're a monk or a nun, between 250 to 360 rules. Yeah, so if when you first meet the Buddha, he seems to say, do what you like. Does it make you feel happy? Do what you like. Are your friends happy? Do what you like. Then you become his disciple and he says, by the way, I've got these rules that you should do. 250, and if you're a nun in Thailand, 368. So what a contradiction. But actually, again, as I read this about the Buddha, I felt very uncomfortable. Here's a kind man. He welcomes me in. He's friendly. And as soon as I start to relax and try and make this man my friend, he challenges me. He tells me what's going to lead to my good. So the Vinaya was made to stop monks doing things that would break up the community of their monks or nuns. That's why this Vinaya grew and grew and grew. The difficulty we have now is that we haven't got the Buddha, and we've simply got these rules. So we've got the letter, but not the spirit. So yeah, you know, one gets the impression, what was the Buddha really like? He was somebody, from what I said so far, somebody who was kind, somebody who was open, but when he taught you, he wanted you to give your whole effort. He wasn't interested in half-heartedness. He pushed you to do the best that you could, not to accept mediocre, not to accept good. And in some ways, I feel very uncomfortable thinking about that. You know, I think I'm doing all right on the spiritual path. But when I read about this, I feel challenged. I don't feel particularly like I want to follow any of the 250 rules, though, but I feel challenged reading about that many rules. So the other thing I want to mention about the Buddha's enlightenment is that he had a family. So, we read about the enlightenment. The Buddha sat under this Bodhi tree. He had these wonderful, blissful experiences that we read about. He entered bliss. He overcame Mara. Life was straightforward after that, wasn't it? Well, no. There's a Zen saying, after the ecstasy, the laundry. And I spent a few years wondering what it meant. You know, what does that mean? It means that after any breakthrough, big or small breakthrough, there's still the laundry waiting there. Yeah, and inevitably, we have to go back to it. So, yeah, the Buddha's family, well, he didn't have a straightforward family life, shall we say. He'd left his kingdom. He'd left his father. Remember, his father expected him to become his heir. He'd left his wife. He had a son. And we won't mention his cousin who tried to kill him. So, you know, life wasn't straightforward after that, after enlightenment. In terms of thinking, do problems go away with enlightenment? No, they don't. But the Buddha was better placed to deal with them. He didn't try and avoid his family. And I'm going to come up to some example now. Yeah, problems don't vanish with enlightenment. So with the Buddha, what was very painful for his father is that he was begging. So the Buddha did go and see his father. I haven't quite got a reading on this, but the crux of the discussion went like this. The Buddha father was aware that he was coming to beg in his town, and the Buddha's father, being the king, was distressed. What is my son doing going out begging in my town when he's my son? And the Buddha's reply was, I am no longer the son of a king. I am in the lineage of the Buddhas. All Buddhas of the past and of the future will beg for their alms. That is the lineage of mine. Which is quite an affront to your father. Your father's saying, don't beg, and you're saying, I'm in a better lineage. I'm not in your kingly lineage. I'm in the lineage of the Buddha. And we're told, through scripture, that he said to his father just one sentence, live a life that is righteous. Live a life that is good. And that one interaction with his father caused his father to become a stream entrant, to have a breakthrough of his own. So maybe the Buddha didn't sort everything out with his father or his wife. His son also became became part of the Sangha as well. So my point here is that just because we're on the spiritual path, we shouldn't forget that maybe they will be unhappy with us. Yeah, maybe they won't be happy with the path that we're leading. Be as skillful as you can. Yeah, maybe you won't be able to stop your own mother or father saying something to you, but be skillful. You know, we're supposed to be the ones that are practicing, but don't expect your difficult family life to become perfect. I'm happy to say that, yeah, I've got difficulties. You know, I really thought for years that I could make my family life better by being a Buddhist. I think I made it worse by applying teachings, to be honest. I think sometimes by simply being kind, you know, that what I call the finger of compassion, I'll put that way. Sometimes just listening. You know, this finger of compassion when you point at somebody, that's not Buddhism, yeah? It's taken me a lot longer than I'm willing to admit on this talk to realise that, and a lot more people telling me. So just be kind. You know, that person who doesn't like what you're doing, they don't think you're kinder. They'll be the first people to tell you that you're arrogant, conceited, unmindful, haven't been practicing well. Bear it patiently. Yeah, bear it patiently. Yeah, so problems don't vanish. Didn't vanish for the Buddha in his spiritual life. And I'm happy and sad to say they won't vanish for us as well. Be as skillful as you can. So the next thing, the Buddha talking and the Buddha keeping quiet. So the Buddha would go and approach people, talk to them, engage with them. He would meet all kinds of people. He would meet courtesans. So courtesan is a very posh way of saying at least exotic dancers, the exotic dancers, and he would engage with anybody. So on most occasions, he would talk. Now, what surprises me here is, on one occasion, the Buddha was approached by someone and asked, what happens after we die? Do we exist? Do we not exist? Or is there neither? And the Buddha remained quiet. So he got asked it again. Do we not exist? What happens after we die? Do we not exist? Do we exist? What happens? And the Buddha remained completely quiet. He didn't answer that question. So despite his worldly wisdom, he knew when to apply that. In this case, the commentaries say that the Buddha spoke when it was useful. And sometimes, if the person he was speaking to, if it wasn't going to be useful, if it was going to make them more confused, more upset, he kept quiet. But then what's very surprising is that a king asks the Buddha. So I'll just read this out. The king asks him this very strange question. He says, so this is a king, this is a commentary in a king. This is a king of Magadha asks the Buddha. He's thinking about attacking the neighbouring town. And he says to the Buddha, he sends a servant to ask the Buddha, I'm thinking about attacking the neighbouring town, the Vijayan Republic. And how will we fare? Will we defeat the neighbouring town? Now you would expect if the Buddha was going to keep quiet about such a ridiculous question, he would not answer it. Someone is saying, I'm going to wage war. Am I going to be successful? But the Buddha answers like this. So he's talking about the neighbouring town, the kind of neighbouring town. As long as the Vijayans meet frequently, hold many meetings, as long as they meet together in unity, rise in unity, perform their duties in unity, as long as they enact nothing enacted, act in accordance with the ancient principles, as long as they respect, venerate, and honour the elders, as long as they have good speech, as long as they are good to their women, as long as they respect and venerate what is right to be venerated, they will not be defeated. So, strangely, you know, the Buddha's saying that because this clan is ethical, because this clan respects each other, because they live in harmony, they meet regularly, you will not defeat them. And I thought that was a really wonderful answer. You know, I was surprised he answered that question, where he didn't answer the question about what happens after we die. So last of all, I'm sorry to debunk any ideas post-enlightenment. Maybe it's better I do that now before you get enlightened. Another thing I learnt about the Buddha, and I have to say, I looked again and again at this. I didn't just look at Wikipedia. I went beyond Wikipedia, just to make sure it was actually true. Someone not winding me up. The Buddha actually had backache in his old age. And I thought to myself, this is the Buddha, you know, he stands at that tree and defeated Mara. But he had backache and he got old. And the Buddha talks like this about his old age. I am old now, worn out, great in years, having gone the pathway of life past its prime, I have reached a point in life which is now 80 years of age. Even as an old cart is maintained by being bound together in various ways, so my body is maintained by being bound together in various ways. So he's saying he's old and his body's falling apart. But with this, with backache, he didn't suffer with his mind. Look at the times that you suffer, any kind of horrible thing. If the worst was to happen to you, what would be worse? The physical pain or worrying about a life physical pain? I would say in my experience, what has caused the most suffering has been worrying about the painful event, the painful meeting with the in-laws, or I've broken my arm. It's more the worry of that. The actual experience of having broken my arm, met the in-laws, getting older, losing my hair. There's nothing to it. Last one, I have to admit, was for comic effect. I'm not really about losing my hair. But isn't it amazing how we worry more about this thing? So it's okay. The Buddha had backache. He could sit. He wasn't worried about his back falling apart. His mind was not disturbed. He could still teach people. And even when the Buddha was dying, a very painful death from food poisoning, he was still able to see people, take visitors, teach them, and teach them the Dharma. So I think that's really amazing. You know, with enlightenment, what the Buddha gained was awakening. But awakening does not mean our bodies will be perfect. We won't have pain. We won't have difficult families. These may still happen, but we're much better equipped. Yeah? When we get enlightened, these difficulties will certainly arise, but they will not obstruct us. In the same way, they did not obstruct the Buddha. So I want to end with a verse from the Threefold Puja. So, of course, this is celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment. This celebrates the Buddha's enlightenment, but we too, we're celebrating this day because we too can gain enlightenment. Yeah? You may not feel like it today, or maybe you do a bit, or maybe a lot, but we too can gain enlightenment. Okay? So we're celebrating our future enlightenment as well as the Buddha's past enlightenment. So I'll just read out and finish with the just a bit of the Threefold Puja. We reverence the Buddha and aspire to follow him. The Buddha was a man as we are men. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. We reverence the Dharma and aspire to follow it, with body, speech, and mind, until the end. The truth in all its aspects, the path in all its stages, we aspire to study, practice, realize. We reverence the Sangha and aspire to follow it, the fellowship of those who tread the way. One by one, we make our own commitment, an ever-widening circle, the Sangha grows.